Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week edition. As you know, we Zoom on Sunday afternoon, so if something should happen Sunday night, we'll be discussing it on Tuesday. We begin our show every day, and we have for months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I kind of wish the impeachment hearings were starting again in 2020, and maybe we'll pull back Vindman. But his testimony was powerful. It was important. It was a description of patriotism. And it's something you need to have ringing in your ears when you decide to exercise the franchise in any way, shape, or form you do, whether it's mail-in voting, whether it's voting in person, whether it's absentee voting, whatever the heck you do, you are voting. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us for our Rethink the Week is a great panel of guests. Our regular Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. He is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio, and we are grateful to have him. How are you, Dean?
Hi, Arnie. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Then we're going to travel south. We're going to go to North Carolina and be joined by Professor Stephen Green. Stephen is a professor of political science at North Carolina State. And again, another person who we have come to embrace and actually need, not only because of our geographic diversity, Stephen, I just want to let you know, it's more than that. I think it's your sense of humor. And maybe to the extent that you're younger than the rest of us. So I think in a lot of ways, you may be closer to what's happening with millennials and students and everything else. So welcome to the program, Stephen.
I am happy to be back as your diversity pick today.
you're welcome. A white young male. Don't you love it?
I'll take the young for sure. At 48, I will take the young.
Okay. And joining us from Rhode Island College, professor of political communication is Val Endres. I have had the pleasure of not only getting to know her, but actually speaking at Rhode Island College. And I miss the fact that we can't do anything in person, but maybe we can do Zoom sometime this fall. So welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here, Arnie.
So this has been such an emotionally shocking weekend. We all knew that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was old. We all know that she'd been on the bench for decades. We all know that she was going through these recurring bouts of cancer, but we thought that she survived everything. You could hit her with a Mack truck and she'd be like, just a minute, I have to write that opinion. I mean, that was how we assumed. And when we got the news that she had died this week, I think for a lot of us, not only was it a shock, and I'm gonna start with you, Val, because she was so important to women, but it was, how do we handle one more blow? How do we do this? I mean, I am looking at the craziness that's happened since 2016 with the election of Donald Trump. I am looking at what's happening with climate change. I'm looking at the disappearance of all norms. I'm looking at the Constitution being shredded. I'm looking at a Republican Party that I can't recognize anymore. I'm looking at a pandemic that's not being given the kind of leadership it needs. I'm looking at the fires burning on the West Coast and the flooding that is happening because of the hurricanes. In fact, I think they ran out of names, someone was saying, because there are so many hurricanes. And then to have RBG die before the election was, I think, too much to bear. And I just wanted to share something with you because my daughter called me at like 4 a.m. in the morning, because she lives in China. And she called me up and she is in complete hysterics. And this is what I posted on Twitter. It's way too early on Saturday morning when my daughter called from China in despair. Her spouse could not understand her anguish. Chinese spouse, why are you crying? She's only a judge. American daughter, no, no. RBG personifies justice. She fought for me. And with my daughter crying and me crying, it's been really hard. And I am just so surprised at how it has hit so many of us in ways that is so both emotional and just compounding the sort of challenges of the future. So I'm gonna sort of toss it to you, Val, and give you a chance to sort of emote or react or comment.
I think there are a couple things to consider. We truly have a void. And part of that has to do with the justice's moral compass. You may not have always agreed with her, but she was a principled jurist and she was a consistent jurist. And there was less guessing where she was going to be on issues, although, you know, it depends upon the complexity of the issues. But I think we're going to miss that. And her moral compass also extended to the fact that she could connect to other people who were ideologically different than herself. And she understood their principle. But what she appreciated was their intellect. Exactly. And so I think that's a huge difference, that you can have a coming together of ideological enemies if they respect your intelligence. And I think she was that kind of a person, and that's who we need to have on the Supreme Court. I am obviously a liberal, but I don't mind having conservatives on the court who understand the law. And I think the implications for that are probably, you know, we've been dealt a number of blows, as you had just listed off. But in some ways, I think we may have awakened the beast. And I think we're moving more toward activism and radical activism in ways that we have not seen in the past. And I think in many ways, we owe that to the millennial generation. We owe it to Gen Z to take action. And we know it's not a fair fight. And so we have to move, and we have to move aggressively.
It's so interesting to me, Stephen, because as I look at all of this, people are more aware of voting than I think they have ever been. This has been the most amazing civics lesson on the planet. I can't even tell you, the garbage man is talking to me. And he's not talking to me about, oh, you didn't sort the stuff right. He's sort of talking to me going, so what do you think, Arnie? I mean, I'm not even like, oh my God. And so the level of penetration is not with us. It's not with the elite. It's not with the wonks. It's not with just, you know, the PhDs and, you know, tech students and whatever. It has really seeped into the conversations of everyone. And I think for the first time, people truly appreciate that elections have consequences. And up until now, I think people didn't really quite get it. Even after the election of Donald Trump, even after 2018 and the, you know, enormous swing, I think people are feeling a sense of consequence that I think is so important, because that's actually how you define democracy. Because elections should have consequences. And when you stop sensing that, democracy dies, Stephen. Democracy dies, and that's how autocrats step in, because it's out of that sense that you don't matter, your participation doesn't matter, and you are not hiring or firing anyone. And in a democracy, you should have the power, and when you check out, it's because you think you have no power.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Hard for me to top that, but I mean, I'm a silver linings kind of guy. It's just who I am. And, you know, they're absolutely, and on the one hand, Donald Trump is, I want to say, like a disaster for democracy in all the ways that, you know, we've cataloged here on your show for so long. But, you know, he has gotten people to pay attention who care about this country and who care about democracy, who were never really paying that much attention before. I was hanging out with my wife and some friends just yesterday, outside, of course, on the deck, right? And talking about the fact that, you know, here were people who 4 years ago who would have no idea who, say, Mitch McConnell was. And now they know exactly who Mitch McConnell is and what a cancer on our democracy he is. And so, you know, that these are people who are now energized and activated. And, you know, this one friend I was talking to is talking about all the work she's going to be doing at the polls in North Carolina. So, I mean, yeah, you know, Donald Trump has put our democracy under great stress. But I feel like a, shall we say, a disease metaphor is appropriate. You know, some of the antibodies are really kicking in. And it is really encouraging to see how many people now kind of get it in a way that they didn't before.
So, Dean, I saw a tweet, and I had to retweet it, but I retweeted it this way. Shattered and frightened, frustrated and in despair, describing myself. And then I read this. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg served until her last day. Representative John Lewis walked the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 2020 after announcing his stage 4 pancreatic cancer diagnosis. Representative Elijah Cummings signed subpoenas from his deathbed. What do we owe them? Everything we can give. Everything we can give. And I needed that. I needed that because I'm not signing subpoenas from my deathbed. I'm not performing weddings. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg performed a wedding like a couple of weeks ago. You know, she was watching herself get an award the night before and saying bravissimo. I mean, it's I look at these people and I'm looking at them and it's not the arc of their life. It's the last hours of their life. And I keep thinking, who am I to check out? Oh my God. And I think that's the other thing about this civics lesson is that it really is about diligence and it's about participation and you don't really have a license to check out, Dean. And that's something that I think is really a good thing to learn.
Yeah, you know, these are all the individuals you named, and we've all known at least one or two people like that in our own individual lives, people for whom their life's work and their life are really indistinguishable, and they're literally going up until the last minute of their lives to accomplish the goals that they've set for themselves and to serve as an example for others. I mean, I think you're right. And we've already had it suggested in our discussion that we're going to see mobilization. In fairness, we're going to see mobilization on both sides. You know, to be from a political perspective, you know, the Trump campaign thinks that filling a Supreme Court vacancy is an ideal way to motivate their supporters to turn out, much in the same way that you're seeing Democratic organizations raise record sums of money in the last 24 hours. This is really going to be a battle royale. The Trump folks think that this will kind of take coronavirus off the front pages for a little while as we cross this horrific 200,000 person death milestone now. It's hard to believe that there could still be people who are ambivalent or not motivated. There really is something for everyone in terms of a need to engage the civic process. And you're seeing in the couple of states, the three or four states that have already started early voting, long lines. People want to make sure that their vote counts.
Can you imagine 40 days out and people are online?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a high mobilization election
for sure.
So Ken, I want to sort of touch on something that Dean said about the fact that what Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and this replacement of the Supreme Court is really a motivator. I'm curious, Ken, whether you think that it's a motivator for the evangelical Christian base who's been motivated about this in perpetuity. They got the court. Who didn't get the court was us. We didn't get the court. We got kumbaya, and we got policy, and we got other things. This, I think, is where maybe Donald Trump is wrong, that there is now a different motivator because his peeps are already motivated by that. That's the only reason why they're holding their nose and voting for a racist, misogynist, sexist, foul-mouthed. The only reason why they're doing it is because of the court. Look what they've had to overcome to kiss him with a French kiss. But for the Democrats and for other people, I think it has changed, and it's a motivator for them in a way that has never existed until this moment.
I really think you're absolutely right, Arnie. I said 4 years ago when Hillary was running, and I would be talking to my friends, and they were kind of ambivalent and not like they were going to vote for Trump, but it's hard to get too excited about voting for somebody who doesn't really excite you politically or otherwise. And I just kept saying to them, you know, you have to vote for the reason of two words, Supreme Court. Yeah. And all the courts. And it was critical then. And it's always been critical for the Democrats. I mean, look at the drift of the courts. Remember, Richard Nixon became president, and all of a sudden, the Warren Court was gone, and you've got at least four strong conservative people. And Reagan appoints more of them. And George Bush appoints Clarence Thomas. Joe Biden, of course, allows that, but we won't go there. But yeah, elections do affect the courts. They affect a lot of other things, too. And I really think that you're right, that the Democrats are going to be motivated by judicial appointments now, in part because McConnell has been so obnoxiously effective at not only filling Supreme Court seats, but, you know, huge numbers of vacancies. People have criticized President Obama for leaving a fair number of vacancies unfilled, for taking middle of the road people, all of that. And it's happened, and we've got to make those changes. And also one other thing, Arnie, I'm sorry. Something about the iconic feel of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, the notorious RBG and all of the adulation, and she's this feisty person. And you go back to day one before she, you know, when she left law school and they told her she could only be a secretary instead of a lawyer because she's a woman.
Yeah.
And she stands up. She was speaking to a 9-male Supreme Court, all male court, in all of those Supreme Court arguments she made when she fundamentally made new law on what equal justice was all about. You know, she's iconic. So it's not like Breyer died. It's Ruth.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, and in a way, and Valach has a really good point what Kid makes, because the worst person and the best person to pay, make us pay attention was RBG. I mean, this was not going to be, oh, the numbers changed. You know what I mean? Where we lost the liberal. This is not even that. I feel like I lost my heart. I feel I lost up an appendage to me. And that's what makes it so shocking. And the other thing that I think is so interesting about her is abortion has been an interesting conversation in my family. I need to tell you guys something. I turned 21 on October 1st, many, many years ago. And you know where I was on my 21st birthday? I was at an abortion clinic in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Now, let me tell you why. Because my best friend was having an abortion and I paid for it. And I was her partner going through it. And it was about a year and a half after Roe v. Wade, right? And you know what I was doing as she was going through her abortion? I was sitting in the waiting room, Val, and I was writing a letter to my grandmother, my Norwegian grandmother in Brooklyn, New York. And why was I writing her a letter? Because my Norwegian grandmother had an illegal abortion. And she told me. And she told me. And she told me how she had this abortion and she had to get rid of the aborted fetus. That was her responsibility. Okay, wrap it up in newspaper and get rid of it. And the reason my Norwegian grandmother had an abortion was because after her only child, my father, the doctor told her that if she had another child, she would die. And there was no birth control that wasn't available. And she had to make a decision. Was she going to leave my father to be raised alone by her husband? Or was she going to be there to raise him? It was Sophie's choice. It was a horrific choice, but she had to make that choice. But she needed me to know that, all right? And so I look at Ruth and her fight and abortion, and so many of my younger women friends have never understood what was at risk. And I think not only the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but what the new appointee could do is so even far beyond repealing Roe, that I think women need to start sort of looking at themselves and saying, what is the integrity of who I am? How am I valued? And this is a court that could really trash everything that we understand as equality.
Well, And I think, and many commentators have talked about this, that we weren't or aren't given the time to even mourn for Ruth Bader Ginsburg because of what's happening. And when Mitch McConnell had announced that he will move forward with the Supreme Court pick, I think for many years, the Democrats believed that we were in a fair fight. Even after Donald Trump was elected, and in his inaugural address, he said, I mean, every indication was there that he would never cross the aisle. And it was a power grab from the very beginning. And we very naively believed in a fair fight. And so I think that's what I mean when we're talking about the fact that we have to awaken the beast. We have to fight back. And quite frankly, I think that's in honor of Ginsburg. I think we're fighting for our very life. We're fighting for the democracy. And you had a very interesting article that you had posted, and I hope your readers read it, that was talking about what are the consequences of McConnell moving forward.
Oh, yeah.
And it means that there's a threat to packing the court. And we may just have to do that. And I know that there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing by Democrats when we so believe in the rule of law, but we understand that that's an opening, whether it's ending the filibuster, whether it's packing the courts, or whether it's adding states, there has to be consequences to action. And I think for so long, the Republicans believed that their power was by divine right. You know, they are the minority. They were not elected with a majority vote. And we naively assumed that they would hold hands from across the aisle and embrace the other side, and because that's what's happened in the past. But this is a whole new age. What I really think means in many ways is that there's a call to arms, but I do believe that we owe it to them.
So I'm listening to Valerie talking about the fact that the Democrats somehow thought that Republicans would sort of exercise some semblance of principle, that they would sort of not be as overtly hypocritical as apparently they are. I mean, Lindsey Graham is my favorite. I mean, if I want to have a definition for hypocritical, I think I'm going to have to put him into the box. But here's what I wrote. I wrote, oh, stop, folks. Republicans do not have consistent political positions or principles. They are Trump windsocks, and the base is fine with that. And I think that's the other problem. There are no consequences for them to be hypocrites. There are no consequences for them to say one thing on one day and one thing on the other. Do you know why, Stephen? Because Trump does that every hour. It's called lying. It's not called hypocritical. It's called lying. And Trump, during the course of a day, will say something at 8 o'clock and say the exact opposite at 10 o'clock. So why should we, of course we can pardon Republicans. They said that a couple of years ago. They've had plenty of time to rehabilitate their positions. And I think that is the other thing is that Trump has so redefined what the standard is that there are no consequences for changing a position, especially something that apparently seemed to be so principled just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, as a lot of people have said, it's just all power politics right now. And whatever Mitch McConnell has the power to do, he's been doing. But of course, as we know, in a properly functioning democracy, there's that principle of democratic forbearance. You don't do everything you can possibly do because that doesn't respect the legitimacy of the other side. And so we have this really interesting question now, which I think Val was so cogently bringing up, is what is the role now for Democrats to do to remedy this? And I read a great essay yesterday saying, there's this idea that if Democrats just, shall we say, do the same and play dirty, that makes us even worse off. But what we need is not Democrats to play dirty, but to play hardball, to whack the Republicans, to hold them accountable. Otherwise, the Republicans, shall we say, these new lesser norms, these lesser small d Democratic norms are what we end up with. So, for example, I would argue that expanding the Supreme Court is an appropriate remedy to what Republicans have done recently. And I would also argue, though, that you want a series of reforms so that the Supreme Court is not this institution subject to the whim of whether somebody dies in September 2020 or, you know, February 2021. And there's all sorts of reforms. And, you know, a case I talked about a lot is Virginia. Democrats took control of the legislature for the first time, the whole government in recent years, after a horrible Republican gerrymander. And what did they do? Did they go and create this horrible Democratic gerrymander? No, they actually put in place the kind of good government reforms that actually work for Democrats.
Right.
So, you know, I hope, again, as a silver linings kind of guy, that this will give us the impetus for, one, the actual tough response that we need, and then those very serious reforms. For example, I would argue statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico and expanding the Senate is a very appropriate response. It's not dirty politics. It may be hardball, but it's what we need to bring our system back closer to a semblance of where it should be.
So, Dean, has anyone actually looked at the Supremes and said, if we were to do some kind of reforms other than, you know, expanding the size, of course, the Republicans contracted the size. So let's understand, we've already been an accordion, okay? We've gotten big, we've gotten small. Now the question is, should we go big? I mean, what about things like term limits? What about things, I mean, what I'm trying to figure out is, should someone serve basically in perpetuity? You know, and I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is the same reason why I have now embraced term limits for legislators and term limits for senators. I used to believe that the voter was the limit. And then I realized that there's, you know, significant power in being an incumbent. Being there is like a real edge. And frankly, what I think is wrong with not having a term limit is we are galloping forward in change. And if you don't know how to use the internet and you don't know how to use email or you are not familiar, you are not only missing what is going on in your country, you are out of step with how to regulate what's changing in your country. So the idea of term limits for senators and House members to me makes sense the way it makes sense for presidents, but I think it actually makes sense for judges because they also are making law whether they want to say they are or not. So I'm just kind of curious if there's any been, like, has there been like 10 things we could do that would make the judiciary better?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I haven't read a lot on that issue of judicial reform. I'm sure there's stuff out there that's not really kind of my main purview, but I know there's a whole segment in political science of people who study judicial politics. And I'm sure there are people, you know, also legal scholars who have studied this issue. In the end, it comes down to who controls the political levers of government, you know, and the argument traditionally has been, don't be too hasty to change things because you may change them to your advantage in the short term, but down the road, the other party may control the levers of government. So hold off, don't be too anxious. And I'm sure we would hear some of that again. The issue of term limits, I have read some arguments about, you know, there was particularly on Congress, I've noticed just anecdotally in the last 10 or 20 years, people now literally stay in Congress until they pass on, basically. You know, we've got Chuck Grassley.
Chuck Grassley is in his
87, 86, something like, he's in his late 80s. And it's just become something that you know, the concept of stepping aside at some point and retiring no longer seems to be relevant for Congress. But again, this gets into an ideological debate. Conservatives believe that, you know, there's a literal way to interpret the intent of the Constitution. Others may say, well, you know, if you have somebody who gets on the bench when they're 48 and is still interpreting law that affects society when they're almost 90, the likelihood that they really understand society at 90 as in comparison to 48, right? You could make that claim that, you know, same thing with Congress. Should the entire Democratic leadership, who's approaching 80, be making policy that has, you know, economic impact on millennials and Gen Z, et cetera. So there's that argument. But what we typically hear is this argument of, well, don't be too hasty because you may change things in the short term and then regret it later.
So Val, you have to excuse me because I'm reading the chats from Stephen. So I gotta respond a little bit to the chat. And Stephen is suggesting an 18-year Supreme Court term. So let me just say something. You know why I like that idea? Because we keep putting infants on the bench. And the reason I don't like that is I want someone with judicial experience. I want someone with judicial temperament. I want to look at a 50-year-old and say, oh, not so bad. Or a 60-year-old and say, not so bad. But now, where am I going? Oh my God, are you 36? That's good. You know, have you finished your law school degree? I think I'll hire you. I mean, they are now not looking at a legacy of history, Stephen. They are now looking at how young can they go. And that to me, that's ageism. That's ageism. And that's wrong too and should be unconstitutional. Anyway, your thoughts, Stephen, and then I'll go back to Val.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I love this idea of 18-year fixed terms. One term is up every 2 years. So you take so much of the randomness, the vagaries out of it. I love RBG, but 18 years from her would have been great. Yeah. As I mentioned in the chat, Rick Perry actually first proposed this idea. So you can't say this is some radical democratic idea, that this is something that really, you know, should have appeal across the spectrum and would solve so many of our problems. And again, as you mentioned, there are so many brilliant jurists who might be 55, even 60 years old, who, and again, to just go after babies, it weakens our system.
And Val, I so resent it. I mean, I actually do. Maybe it's because now I'm 66 and I want people to understand, you know, I might not be so bad on the bench. But before we go to the break, Val, I also wanted to share one other thing. And that is, since I started with you about RBG, I'm going to end this segment with you about RBG. And she was asked for her definition of feminism. And everyone, I freaking love this. Here's what she says. I think the simplest explanation and one that captures the idea, it's the song that Marlo Thomas sang in Free to Be, You and Me. Free to be, if you're a girl, a doctor, a lawyer, an Indian chief, anything you want to be. And if you're a boy and you like teaching, you like nursing, you'd like to have a doll, that's okay too. That notion that we should each be free to develop our own talents, whatever they may be, and not be held back by artificial barriers, man-made barriers. Certainly not heaven sent. That she would go to Marlo Thomas and Free to Be, You and Me. God, is she a genius, Val.
Well, and we owe a debt of gratitude to Ginsburg for what she has done for women, but also for men. Because remember, many of her court cases were on behalf of men to prove that there's gender discrimination. And two, don't underestimate her ability to write a good dissenting opinion. And she has absolutely been a leader that way and propelled Obama with the Lilly Ledbetter Law.
Exactly, exactly. All right, we need to go to a break. This is our Monday edition of the Attitude Rethink the Week with our producer, Ken Barnes, and of course, our great panel of guests, Dean Spiliota, Stephen Green, and Val Endres. We'll be right back.
There's a land that I see where the children are free, and I say it ain't far to this land from where we are. Take my hand, come with me where the children are free. Come with me, take my hand, and we'll live in a land where the river runs free. Children are free. Come with me, take my hand, and we'll move.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude, our Rethink the Week. This is Arnie Arneson with producer Ken Barnes. Our panel of guests, Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Green, a political science professor from North Carolina State, and Val Endres, a political communication professor from Rhode Island College. Dean, I'm going to go to you. I saw a tweet this morning, and it is something I have been talking about ad nauseum. And that is, we keep talking about the 200,000 deaths. And by today, Sunday, we may have reached that mark, but definitely by Monday, we will have reached it. And that's a horrific thing. But what happens to people that survive? Because in a horrible way, death ends the conversation about caring for someone. You have to worry about their family. You have to worry about the emotional impact on people. But you don't care for them anymore. You've buried them. The people that survive, however, COVID-19, that is a real significant consequence. Listen to this stat that just came out of some medical journals. "This is scary," was the tweet. 50% of asymptomatic SARS-CoV-2 patients had abnormal lung CT scans. This is the asymptomatic D. This is not the ones that went on the ventilators. This is not the one that filled the hospital bed. This is not the people that got really sick but were able to stay home and do whatever, sleep on their stomach or whatever they were supposed to do. These are asymptomatic people. And that is just one aspect of COVID-19 that we are beginning to understand. And what I wrote after I saw that tweet is, can we talk healthcare, folks? How is that private insurance model working for you? Medicare for all? Just asking. Because now I am seeing that we are looking at a health consequence where we already know we have so many people with pre-existing conditions already, Dean. But now COVID-19 is going to up that number in a way we have never, ever planned for.
Yeah, there's been some pretty interesting and surprising articles I've read over the last few months about these so-called, particularly people who get sick and then recover. I mean, asymptomatic abnormal scans, that's one level. But then the folks who actually have symptoms, it often can take months and months, and they're still barely able to get out of bed some days. They call them the long haulers. And these folks have lung scarring. They may need a lung transplant. They may be on kidney dialysis the rest of their lives or even need a kidney transplant. They're having cognitive issues, myocarditis, the swelling of the heart. It's scary. And I think it behooves Democrats to keep the whole issue of healthcare front and center in the election, not only the pandemic, but the Trump administration's case, the president's inability to produce an alternative to Obamacare, even though Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, is now assured us that it's moments from being unveiled. There was a great montage of all the times that Trump has told journalists that the plan was coming in the next 2 weeks, literally going back a year. And so it's something the Democrats can certainly focus on in the context of this sort of longer term costs of COVID-19 to families.
And you know, Stephen, as I'm listening to him, the new thing that's being used is that I think I just heard Joe Biden. I mean, I'm multitasking, but Joe Biden was talking about RBG and her passing and that they shouldn't, you know, appoint another Supreme Court. But now they are framing the appointment of a judge on the pandemic and on healthcare. And I'm thinking this is great. Because I keep saying the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. Now we got the Supreme Court justice is the pandemic and it's the healthcare. I mean, it's so interesting how we're creating this fascinating web of pulling people in based on their different concerns, but they all kind of land together and the pandemic still becomes the central argument for now the Supreme Court case, for the economy, for all these things. And I thought that was a pretty interesting weave.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, because honestly, when you get down to it, Joe Biden is looking out for you and Donald Trump, not so much. And you know, I think there's such a compelling case to be made with COVID and the pre-existing condition issue and the Supreme Court issue, right? Which we know Ruth Bader Ginsburg's replacement will be quite ready to strike it down. And that it's, imagine, I think even people who aren't afraid of having COVID, they think they'll get COVID. It's right, well, I'll get COVID, it'll be no big deal. But tell them, how about that for a pre-existing condition, right? How about under Donald Trump's world, all of a sudden, oh, you had COVID, pre-existing condition, you know, your insurance is going to cost five times as much. And that is exactly what Donald Trump's, every action he has taken, his words entirely to the contrary. You know what, I want Joe Biden in a debate to say to him, what exactly is protection for pre-existing conditions? I don't think Donald Trump knows. He just knows that this is something people like, and he trots this, oh, well, I'm protecting pre-existing conditions. Well, of course, his government does everything it can to try and undermine it. Anyway, so I think this is definitely something that Democrats need to dig into and message on, and that can very much work with the Supreme Court issue.
And I'm going to go, Val, the pandemic, so we talk about the Supreme Court decision, the economy, we're going to talk about healthcare. I'm going to make the pandemic connected to climate change. How do I get to do that? Because I saw the smoke and the red sun from California, Oregon, and Washington. And where do I live? I live in Concord, New Hampshire. Well, how the hell did the smoke from the West Coast get to me? Well, that's the other thing we also know about the pandemic, is that pollution and that smoke and that the ash in the air is also just accelerates the complications from the pandemic, from the flu, from any pre-existing conditions. So now, not solving climate change, on top of having a pandemic, on top of finding out that, you know, you could suffer all these consequences from it, when you look at all these things, there is such a tight weave. And I have to ask the Trump voter, did your house burn in Oregon? I have to ask the Trump voter, did your house burn in California? I have to ask the Trump voter in Mississippi, did you flood after that hurricane? Just kind of curious. I'm just wondering whether his mythology protected you, because I suspect, Val, it didn't.
Well, and we all know that we're tumbling down the hill toward calamity unless we start looking in the long term. So I have relatives who live in Washington State, and they have been told, several of their doctors, my brother-in-law sees doctors regularly because of a heart condition, that they said that they're seeing the same sort of lung activity that they were seeing with COVID, an increase of clots, increase of particulates in the lungs that's coming from the air. And scientists are still unsure when the air actually clears. And so they're even making predictions that too could happen on the East Coast. And we know that the drought will continue through the fall and probably next spring. So unless we start getting a handle on some of these issues, like you talked about healthcare, and if we don't do something to further protect people for single payer, if we don't start thinking about Medicare for all, if we don't start thinking of some of the, at least some of the elements of the Green New Deal, we're in terrible shape. And particularly when we're looking at ourselves as a world power and being competitive in this world.
Well, Dean, I want to sit down with a bunch of CEOs. They're making lots of money on the stock market. I'm really happy for them. But the problem is that if they're going to be looking at the cost of workers, and the cost of workers now, if they're going to cover them in any way, shape, or form for healthcare, their costs are going up because they've decided that this is part of their benefit package. They like private insurance. They want to know. No, they don't. They never liked it. And now they got to really, really hate it, because now they now have this whole crop of people who, you know, we've always known that we've spent more in healthcare than any country in the world. We already know that we have too many uninsured and underinsured. We already know that we're not even healthy with all the money that we're, pardon the expression, pissing away. But now we're spending all this money and we have a pandemic that's causing more people to have pre-existing conditions that, boys and girls, you're going to have to pay for. Because even though the health insurance company said, we'll cover you for COVID, I don't think they mean this. I mean, I think they may mean a vaccine or they may mean a test, but I don't think they mean what we're seeing now with lung transplants and, you know, lung scans and everything else. I think this is a really interesting sort of come to Jesus moment, even for the Chamber of Commerce boys.
Well, that's the question. Will we see a change in perspective as a result of this. I don't know. It's certainly possible. My sense with Biden has been fairly clear that he's interested in reforming or some aspects of Obamacare, but that he's not necessarily sold on single payer or Medicare for all. The belief of some progressives is that they'll set about pulling him in that direction. But who knows? Perhaps if, as you say, the costs are so much higher now for businesses, given the health cost of long-term side effects from COVID, maybe that'll change the kind of conventional wisdom, or that there'll be more support from the business community. Because right now it's kind of a mixed bag. And Biden seems to kind of be playing it down the middle of the road at the moment.
So here's my deal, Stephen. I want to sit down with Jeff Bezos because he's hiring left and right. And I want to sit down with Jeff and say, so Jeff, Biden wants to do the ACA, but it wants to expand on it. So Jeff, here's my recommendation. Tell him that all your employees will go on the public option. I want to endorse the public option. And then I want him to sit down with maybe, I don't know, the Google people or the whatever people. And I want to sort of pull every CEO that we know has a large, footprint, Walmart, And I think what happens is that I don't want to call it Medicare for All. I want to call it a public option with 94.9% of the people joining it. And we'll let the 6% that want to buy their own go for it, babies. You can have it. Because frankly, let's be honest, the rich have always had their own insurance plan. Whether they lived in Great Britain, whether they lived in Canada, I don't care. Because they could go to the Mayo Clinic. So they've always had their own insurance. We just didn't recognize what it was. I think, Stephen, I think that's where the opportunity comes. Maybe we're caught up in a word. We're not caught up in the real sort of concept that is both important for the bottom line as well as important for the health of the community.
I agree entirely. And, people have talked a lot about a robust public option, for example. How about a really robust
public option?
And the reality is that there's a lot of various ways to have a far more effective healthcare system for most Americans than we have now, but that all of them go through politics. And politics is messaging. And if Medicare for All gets us there, I'll take it. If, robust public option for all gets us there, I'll take it. And if there's something that really works with the business community and gets them on board, which they should be, because, they shouldn't want to have to be responsible for the insurance of their employees. Like, again, the rest of the world doesn't do this. Then I'm for that. So just in that sense, yes.
Val, I started my political career in 1984. And the very first piece of legislation I wrote had to do with healthcare, boys and girls. Are you surprised? Of course not. Because I had my first baby born without health insurance. And I worked 50 hours a week, but I worked 3 part-time jobs. None of them were full-time, so therefore I couldn't get into the employer's plan because there was no group health insurance for a part-time worker. So what did I do? I wrote legislation that said insurance companies could not discriminate against part-time workers for the position of being able to participate in group health plans. Here's the interesting thing. Do you know who I got to go along with me? Because I did exactly what Stephen did, suggested. I went to the business community and I said, you're having difficulty getting employees, right? Wouldn't you like to be able to say to your part-time workers, well, if it's up to me, I might be able to throw in a little group health insurance for you. But the reason why they couldn't was the insurance companies wouldn't allow them. So this was a law that applied to insurance companies that you couldn't be the gatekeeper and say no, leaving it to the employer to still have the option of saying yes or no. Guess what, Val? We got the chambers, we got the rotaries, we got them all. They love the idea of giving them a choice because the insurance companies had taken away the choice, Val. And I think that's really, again, it's the marketing that Stephen is saying is how do you package it? Because guess what? You might even find out that you might be backing into conservatives.
That could be, but that would be bucking some trends. And I worry about, depending upon Sam Walton or Jeff Bezos, altruism. And I think their most likely response is to cut down on the number of people who they cover with health insurance. And we'll go back to that time where we have more part-time workers rather than full-time workers. So I'm not sure if the trends hold for the last 15 years I don't think we can depend upon CEOs. I think what we have to do is it's part of that package that if Biden wins and the Democrats win, they have to to draw the battle lines. And I think the progressives in many ways have to have a sit down with Joe Biden to talk about how can we expand Medicare in meaningful ways to cover people. I just worry, and I understand that on an individual basis that may have worked, but I have a hard time believing if the Sam Waltons or the Jeff Bezos would be reluctant, then their board certainly would be.
There was an article, Dean, that said, you know who's really discouraged about capitalism? Millennials. They feel like they've been screwed and screwed and screwed. They're on this capitalism stuff. I don't think I want to talk to a CEO. I don't think I want to be in the same room with a CEO. I mean, so in a lot of ways, what I'm hearing from Val is what I hear from a lot of younger people, which is you think you can negotiate with them. They don't give a crap about you, Dean. They give a crap about, you know, what's in their portfolio, and you come at that sort of at the back of the bus. So it's so interesting the times we live in. But what I wanted to sort of do before we end the show is talk a little bit about the sort of the three-legged stool. So we've talked about healthcare, we've talked about the Supreme Court and the election. What we haven't talked about is what else the pandemic has harmed, and that is education. And I saw an article at the Christian Science Monitor that actually mirrored something I have been saying for a long time. And it was about the country of Bolivia. And Bolivia decided to do something very interesting. There ain't school this year. They canceled school. They canceled it. I didn't go quite as far as Bolivia, but I've been talking to people across the street that are like Zooming their classes, and I've been talking to teachers at, you know, universities. And let me tell you about at least with the elementary school and middle school people. What they're saying is if you're going on even partially online, a lot of kids aren't showing up. They're not connecting with their Zoom. They're not staying all day. They're erratic. So you're sometimes wondering whether you're teaching 2 or teaching 22. And so I'm wondering whether we should even have this conversation and not call this academic year 2020-2021, but call it the COVID year. So it doesn't even have academic meaning. In a lot of ways, we all take a pause because it kind of reflects what's happening in our lives, what's happening in our economy, what's happening in everything else. Why should we think children should be different? That doesn't mean you don't learn. It just may mean that you may not matriculate. Is that a horrifically terrible thing to say? Because I think in some ways it's probably the fairest thing to say and the most honest, but I'm not sure honesty gets you anywhere these days. Dean?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that was segueing to Professor. Yeah, absolutely. So, I understand what you're saying. I think there's a lot of practical concerns with that. You know, there'd have to be something obviously to fill that void. You know, I can speak to that at the university level. There's obviously variation across different universities and different colleges. Some are in residence, but with tremendous restrictions, and you're kind of in and out of quarantining and in and out of remote classes, depending on the level of infection on campus. Others like SNHU, where I am, is fully remote. Many other schools are like that as well now. It does pose challenges for the students. There's wide variation in people's life circumstances, their access to technology, the ability to keep other familial and you know, personal matters kind of interfering on your ability to study. The problem is there just doesn't seem to be any one solution that makes everybody happy. And as I said before, I have several families.
I'm not looking for happy. Happy is just
people's ability to function in their lives, not even a function of whether or not they're happy. But, as I've told you, I have a couple family members who are in higher ed and administrative positions, and you hear one case being made by one set of parents, and you hear the diametrically opposite case being made by many other parents. And so you're sort of, so the proverbial between a rock and a hard place where everybody in the end is unhappy about something. So, you know, to just kind of call it all off, you know, I understand the appeal of that at some level. The trick is figuring out what would take that place.
So, Stephen, one of the things I want to talk to you because you have young children. So I'm so glad you're here. You know, the rest of us, not so much. So how is it working for your kids? What responsibility do you have to see that education happens between the shared responsibility of a husband and a wife? Are they engaging? Are they paying attention to this screen all day? Well, or are they in class? What's happening with your children?
Okay, so right, I have a lot of firsthand observations on this.
I know you.
Right? And what it says to me is everything that we're worried about in terms of the inequalities of society get worse. I mean, my two youngest kids, they have been well-educated. They have good educated parents who care about their education, and they are just zooming along fine, as far as I can tell. You know, but I know that not other classmates are. I know they are telling me, yeah, I only see this kid, you know, some of the time. I was at, you know, back to school virtual night the other night, and, you know, the teacher's saying, you know, some of the kids just aren't even showing up. Some of the kids are taking a week to do stuff that should take a day. And then, oh my gosh, my second son, he is in high school. He's in an intellectually moderately disabled special education class. And my wife spends 4 hours in that Zoom with him every day, because he can't do that by himself. But not many families can do that. And they're so, and my wife sees these other families because she's seeing inside their house, and she's seeing these kids who are struggling and getting nothing. And it's heartbreaking, honestly. And it's just, you know, for me, it's just like, let us do everything as a society focused on making it safe for kids back in school. And yeah. And the fact that we are not is so frustrating and so heartbreaking, because again, my family were great, but it gives me this window, direct window really, into how not great it is for so many families.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. So Val, there's, again, I get to sort of watch across the street. So what's been really interesting for me is, you know what they're doing? So while they're zooming into their students' lives from the school, special ed kids are going to school. And so you see the buses drop off kids, but not a lot of kids, a small number of kids. It's the special ed kids. Right now they can do a lot of outdoor activity with them and whatever, but they've already been sort of discreet anyway. And now because there are fewer kids, they're able to do it in an interesting way, a little more hands-on, because they have the time. But as one of the teachers said, I wish every one of my kids was a special ed kid, because that's not fair either. Because I can tell you about the kids that we're just hearing about with Steven that have lots of, you know, parent support. But she said, but there's 10 kids in my class that have none of that support, and they're not checking in. And I think that's problematic as well.
It is so important that we look outside our privileged bubble, because those in higher ed certainly are in that bubble. And one of the things is, for example, I have students that have children and there's one computer in the home and they have to share that to both go to school themselves. But also I have first generation students who are on a timeline with student loans and everything else, and they want school to progress.
And on that note, I have to end this conversation or I'll get shot by Ken Barnes, my producer. Thank you so much. It's our Rethink the Week. We should definitely be doing 2 hours. Stephen Green, Dean Spiliotis, Val Endres, Ken Barnes, thank you so much. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you will be so missed. Ciao. We'll talk tomorrow.
Rest in power, Ruth.
Rest in power.
Oh, tell it on the mountain.